When the baby boomers were growing up, the Peter Sellers we knew was the British actor, the man of many faces who played Inspector Clouseau in the original Pink Panther films, among many other roles. About the time that Peter Sellers died in 1980, another Peter Sellers was just getting started on a long and illustrious career. This Peter Sellers, originally from Pittsburgh, made a name for himself with groundbreaking productions of operas and plays, doing Wagnerian opera with puppets, Antony and Cleopatra in a swimming pool, and Don Giovanni as a blaxploitation film. Peter Sellers is still directing, now teaching at UCLA, and currently visiting Southern Oregon University to share a few thoughts. He's a graduate of Harvard and a veteran of many a theater and opera company. He won a MacArthur Genius Grant 35 years ago. He's been artistic director of the Los Angeles Festival, the American National Theater at the Kennedy Center, the Boston Shakespeare Company, and the Ehlich Theater for Children in Denver. I have joked we could spend the hour just reading your resume. Peter Sellers, thanks for being here.
Let's move forward.
Truly. So I noticed when you Google Peter Sellers in controversy, there are 59,500. I was going to ask if that produces a giggle, a roll of eyes, or something else.
No, you've got to be lucky that, you know, what we're here to do as artists is create a discussion. You know, and so when you do work that everybody has to talk about, thank you. That is the job description. That is what it's meant. It's not if everybody says, oh, that's wonderful, then there's no conversation. If everybody says, that's just terrible, there's no conversation. What is really my good fortune is that half the people say, oh, thank God somebody has finally done this. And the other half say, this should be illegal. And so the combination is very exciting. I mean, it makes for some ugly reviews, but I don't actually hold that against the critics because they have to come up with something in like the hour after they see one of my shows. And my shows are meant to be discussed for months. And so, you know, they're not meant to be, you can't sum it up on your way out. It doesn't reduce to a soundbite. It is a conversation that you're meant to have with everyone.
So has a critic ever come back 6 months later and said, you know, I've been thinking, and well, here's what I think now.
I would, every once in a while, you have really somebody amazing. Incredible, kind of legendary Chicago critic did this beautiful thing. When I did Merchant of Venice, you know, we the show was sold out months ahead of time. You could not get a ticket at the Goodman Theater. And I have to say, starting with the first preview, I think already 5 minutes into the performance, people started leaving the auditorium in disgust. And the performance was evacuated. About half the auditorium was empty. And I was joking with the management of the theater, you could treat it like a restaurant and have a second seating, you know. And in fact, Merchant of Venice is about young people. And the subscribers were their parents. And you could actually see the level of denial of their parents not wanting to see their kids say this stuff or even acknowledge that it existed. And so the rage in the room was just amazing. And we had made that show actually with high school students in the room every single day in the rehearsals. And it actually was and the high school students were cheering and creating this incredible, talking back to the Shakespeare characters. It was alive. And then we showed it for their parents and we were in a dead zone. And it was pretty powerful. And also it was racially charged because Merchant of Venice is racially charged. And it also had to do with, you know, as usual, the court system siding with the wrong side. And the people rubbing their hands in triumph that they won again, but not realizing, in fact, they lost. They lost. All of humanity lost. Shakespeare's point is you may have won the court case, but the human race lost today. And that was a really hard message for that audience to hear. All of which is to say Richard Christensen, the great critic of the Chicago Tribune, wrote one of the most beautiful reviews. He said, this may not be your idea of Shakespeare, and it is certainly not mine, but you must go see it.
Wow.
So, I mean, there is that some where somebody will give you the right to live and will actually say there's not just one way to do something and will acknowledge that even if you disagree with someone's voice, it should be heard. And that is, of course, what America stands for, is not just the voices you agree with, but all the voices have to be present and have to be represented, and then let democracy go from there.
But that is a real challenge of our time, isn't it? Where it doesn't take much out of the mouth of the other person, if anything, to have person B starts to talk and person A says, no, you can't say that, or I totally disagree with you, or you shouldn't be on my campus, or any one of the other ways in which that plays out in our time.
Yeah, and a lot of proto-fascist organizations are, you know, regional theaters and art museums, because you're only seeing what the director likes. And so what does it mean to actually have a range of stuff out there? And so for me, that's one of the most exciting things in the arts. When I went from the Kennedy Center to the Los Angeles Festival, we programmed the Los Angeles Festival with 350 curators.
Wow.
Which meant that we were showing a lot of stuff that I didn't like at all, and yet for someone was very important. And actually, I had to learn the lesson that and learn to like things that I actually didn't like, and finally realize that if you're going through life just based on what you like or don't like, you're missing most of the creation of the universe.
So do you ever put things on stage that even make your own skin crawl? Things that you know, you just, oh my God, I'm uneasy watching this, but it has to be done.
Well, I you know, it's like an argument in your family. You know, until whether you agree with it or not, until someone has the right to say it, no one will be safe. And so you've actually got to create, you know, violence in your family or in the Middle East or in South Central Los Angeles is a result of lack of communication. You know, when the channels of communication are open and people can express something difficult, then they don't have to put a bomb in your car. Nobody has to be shot. You know, you can acknowledge somebody even though you don't agree with them and give them the right to exist and actually support them. And we can move past the violence. And so I think artists' job is to be that space where in places where communication has been blocked, and usually quite deliberately, we have to find a way to open an avenue of communication. And again, the communication is never something that, you know, you necessarily is friendly. I always think of it as, who's going to tell Dad what Dad doesn't want to hear?
Right.
You know?
We will hear more of the theory from Peter Sellers when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. By the way, we'll be talking tonight at 5:30 at the Mies Auditorium in the Arts Building on the Southern Oregon University campus, sort of a replay of this interview. All the things we don't get in this interview, we'll do tonight at 5:30.
Oh, yeah, please.
Looking forward to it. So we'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Peter Sellers, who has directed, I can't even begin to imagine the number of operas and plays, and he can't either, he says, over the years. He's visiting the Southern Oregon University campus from his latest perch at UCLA and looking to another bunch of things coming up. Tristan and Isolde in Paris, I guess, in September you'll be directing. But you can join the conversation here and now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address jx@jeffnet.org. We've established the connection between Peter Sellers and controversy and the fact that you know, you do art because you feel like all voices need to be heard. So do you remember a moment when you started thinking like this, or has it just been part of your fiber since the womb?
Well, I just think it's what makes life interesting. It's what makes America the greatest country in the history of the world, is we're the first people who actually put that into law and just said, actually, until all voices are heard, there cannot be peace or prosperity. And peace and prosperity are based on people's ability to express themselves and express themselves liberally and with conviction and power, and that we're not going to just establish one truth. We're going to make a space that's spacious enough and capacious enough for all these truths to live together. And that's really powerful.
Did activism come first? Did art come first? Have they always been completely intertwined in your mind?
You know, I've never ever thought of it as activism, because it's all the things you basically value in life, and you value in American life. And for me, the thrill was, you know, growing up in Pittsburgh, going to the Carnegie Museum, where, you know, Andrew Carnegie, you know, collected all this, you know, art from old Europe and all that stuff. And there's a amazing natural history museum. There's an amazing concert hall. There's amazing contemporary, all in one building. You walk into the building, and the lobby has these gigantic murals of steel workers. And like right there, you're not forgetting who's paying for this and who's working at this moment so that you can look at a painting. That's just incredible. And that's the reality, is these utterly separate realities are in fact supporting each other. And so you have to be grateful to all of them, and you have to acknowledge all of them.
So let's talk about the skills you bring to your work. I mean, to direct opera in particular. I mean, I heard somebody's comment that you read scores better than the musicians. So what do you look for when you're starting with a work? I mean, either in music or libretto or both, to be able to give you some guide to how to proceed.
Well, what you look for every day of your life are amazing people, because nobody does it alone. I'm clueless. I'm so bad reading music. I'm pathetic. But I do work with great musicians who can say, you know, Peter, look at this over here. You know, and it's just like the greatest thing is when people just take you aside and say, you know, by the way, notice this. And when you're working with the best people, and I was really fortunate because already in my early 20s, I was working with some of the greatest people in the world, major actors, incredible singers, incredible musicians, and filmmakers, and so on. And so I was just surrounded by ideas and points of view and ways of understanding that were way better than mine. And so the best thing is when you have friends who save you from yourself. and so all my life, what I have done is really had the amazing opportunity to gather amazing people. And so that creates a kind of dialogue where everybody goes beyond their last 12 ideas. And we're all going like to this place that none of us have ever gone before, because you've never been in the room with people that diverse or that surprising or that challenging. And so the result is the performance usually reflects everybody making their own breakthrough. And when you're seeing people on stage who are right in the middle of their own personal breakthrough, that's what you want. You want to see a human being in the moment when their mind opens, when their world expands, when they suddenly become capable of understanding something they never understood or facing the very thing they were always afraid of. And so that for me is what performance is about. It's like watching the Olympics. You want to see somebody achieve something that was officially impossible before, and suddenly they're doing it. And you set that task up for actors or musicians. You're setting up a situation where everybody is facing something that none of us knows how to solve. And now they're doing it with some kind of new understanding, some kind of new courage, some kind of new information, and some kind of new support that they never felt before, or conversely, some kind of new horrifying challenge that demands they reach into a place they've never had to reach into before, and they find something about themselves they never knew.
Peter Sellers is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of many operas and plays and even a couple of films over the years, visiting Southern Oregon University. I've often wondered that about performers, though. I mean, you want to get things out of yourself, like just like you're talking about here. But is it a good thing to be surprised on stage, or would you prefer that happens in rehearsal?
Well, it depends on the medium. I mean, theater and film, you want to be surprised every second. And if you're not surprised, it's a boring night. Whereas
performers, though.
The performers. Yeah. Whereas in opera, the trains do have to run on time. I mean, truly, you know, the C-sharp does have to come on this chord and, you know, the third beat of bar three. So the opera, you know, needs to be highly organized in order to function. Whereas theater, every time these two actors look at each other, they have to see something they never saw before. And you're present for them to actually say, oh, my God, what am I doing? What am I going to do next? And that is really, really powerful in theater. And, of course, film is recording the moment of first contact. Film is recording your first idea and your involuntary response. And that is thrilling to have a record of that. And if it's been you've had too many takes before it in a movie, it's just horrible. You're seeing something so damn premeditated. And so it doesn't – you can't believe it as real life. And so and the best moments in your life are genuinely the moments in your life where you're surprised. And so for me, that's the pure gold. That's the treasure you're actually hunting for.
So it seems like in order to construct the kinds of works of art you do, you certainly have to deconstruct. And I think you were getting to this when you talked about The Merchant of Venice. It's like you may have won the court case, but you lost the human race, or the human race lost. So, I mean, are you able to boil everything you do down to a theme like that?
No. I mean, for example, that Merchant of Venice had a cast that was primarily black and Latino and Asian. And what happened was, Shylock and his friends were African Americans. The Portia and her friends were wealthy Asian Americans, and then everyone else were Latinos living in Venice Beach. And I set it in California after the uprising, and in Los Angeles when the city was on fire, and we had the U.S. Army rolling down the streets in tanks and curfews, and so looking like Prague or something
after the Rodney King case.
Yeah, so very, very powerful, very intense. But of course, most of those actors had never been asked to play Shakespeare before in that era, pre-Bill Rausch. And so what we did was we spent the first week making our Library of Human Experience. We read through the play, and after every line, all 18 people in the room said what that line made them think of, an experience in their life. And you realize that no two of us were hearing any line the same way. You realize someone connected it with an experience. This Jamaican kid had an experience you could never have imagined. And suddenly you realize, just to say that line, we thought we agreed on what it meant. We realize we don't agree on it. And that was a super rich experience. And then we did a whole second week of reading, you know, how capitalism underdeveloped Black America, and the Tao Te Ching and passages from the Bible that all matched where Shakespeare was going. So by the time you open that stuff up, the play is so rich and teeming with possibilities, and nothing reduces. Everything just expands, which is why Shakespeare is Shakespeare, because it doesn't go to a soundbite. It goes to – it blows your mind open with the infinity of human life, and that's what's thrilling.
Peter Sellers, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the director of operas, plays, and films. He is visiting Southern Oregon University's campus for some events on campus with students and without. And there's a public session tonight at 5:30 at the Meese Auditorium. We'll basically be continuing this.
Just pick up where we left off.
I'm going to ask the audience to raise their hands. If you heard the radio show, can we move on to the next? But you can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So ultimately, as the director, I mean, you have a vision for how you would like things to go, but with all the collaboration you take in from performers and everybody else involved, I mean, have things taken a real radical turn over the course of a production from what you envisioned to what ended up on stage?
It's what you pray for.
Really?
If you're watching the last rehearsals and there's nothing but your ideas on stage, you failed. You know, what you want to see is that what's on stage is unrecognizable from what you started with, that everybody has contributed and the thing has morphed and morphed and transformed, and you're looking at something that is only the product of this amazing group of people coming together in a way that nobody ever came together before and creating a new set of possibilities for human beings. So for me, the other thing that you're not really hoping for, because it's super painful, but unless a production goes through a giant crisis, probably what you're doing is not very important. And so you actually have to, when the crisis hits, say thank you, even though it's so painful. It's so unpleasant. But in fact, it lets you know that we're doing something that needs to be done, and that we're going to a place that hurts and that needs attention. And it's just like when, you know, the doctor knows to touch you there, because that's the place where it actually hurts and where the work needs to be done. And so when you identify that, and usually it gets identified in quite an explosive and unexpected way, then the healing work begins. But also the challenging work begins, because again, like any serious treatment, it's going to hurt for a while, and everybody has to actually be courageous and strong in that period. And again, you get to everybody's better selves, you know, when we all have to do something that's asking more of us than we were prepared to offer.
So what kind of crisis? Are we talking about personality clashes or artistic differences or something else?
You know, human beings are carrying with them so much emotion and so much pain that is mostly unexpressed. And mostly repressed. And mostly they repress it themselves, let alone never daring to admit it to another person. Most people don't even themselves acknowledge what they're feeling most of the day. So you've got these, you know, time bombs walking around on two legs. And when it never gets expressed, it just gets internalized. And when you keep something in a small, dark, airless box forever, it turns to poison. And it just turns it, the toxicity increases. And so one of the things that theater was invented to do was get people's darkest, weirdest, most hurt selves out into the open, out into the fresh air, out into the sunlight, so we can at least look at it. And so it doesn't have to be pure poison if we can get to it early enough. So, and we're all carrying that stuff. And inevitably, if you're working on Shakespeare or Sophocles or, you know, Mozart or whatever it is, that's something that's really profound, you're digging around in there. And the geyser that erupts totally unexpectedly just because you were drilling nearby is what rehearsal's about. And you're, again, I think of it, what I think of rehearsal as is the protected zone. You're giving people a protected zone. Safe place to express something really difficult and that they don't feel they've ever had permission to express before. And again, many times people didn't even know that they were carrying it with them. But something gets triggered in a rehearsal and suddenly all this stuff comes out. And then the community has to handle it. And first of all, we have to go to that place that no human being is alone. And what it is when you're going through something difficult, you need friends. And you need friends when you're at your worst, not when you're at your best. And so that you and we have to know, you know, as human beings, you have to be not with someone when they're it's nice to be with them. You have to be with them when it's really difficult to be with them. That's when you have to be with them. And you can't abandon somebody when they're at their most difficult. So that's what a rehearsal process is staying with people in solidarity as they're going through a really hard patch. And again, until we go through, each of us goes through those difficult spaces of our lives, we're not fully alive to ourselves, much less each other. And all the stuff we're holding back also means we're holding back on our relationships, we're holding back on all of our own individual possibilities, but also the possibilities of the people around us. So it's a very it's a profound thing, human beings, and getting to know them and getting to understand them and getting to unfold all this stuff that is so tightly packed. That's an unbelievable privilege.
Grab your headphones, please. We have a phone call for you. Let's go to Lawrence in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Peter Sellers.
I've seen a couple of traditional productions of the St. Matthew Passion at the Oregon Bach Festival and by Philippe Herravega. And relevant to what Mr. Sellers has just been talking about, it's kind of hard for the average viewer to relate to those events and relate the events of witnessing the St. Matthew Passion to contemporary life. I read a glowing review in the New Yorker about Mr. Sellers' adaptation of that, his staging of the Passion, that really engaged the participants. They moved around on stage, and the singers related directly to an ensemble of the musicians, for example. So I'd just like to hear him talk about his process in staging that.
Okay, thanks for that, Lawrence. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you so much. Good heavens. You know, the Matthew Passion was a long time coming. I worked in Boston at Emmanuel Church for 10 years where they did a Bach cantata every Sunday. And we really grew up with Bach while we were working on Mozart and everything else. And Bach really is all of Bach's music is really a 12-step program. Bach is really taking you from a very painful place and giving you step by step how you're going to make it through. And Bach starts with, you know, suicide, with, you know, he goes right to the scariest places. You know, cantata 199 is the suicide cantata, for example, is, you know, my heart swims in blood and I'm a monster in the eyes of God. That's the opening line. And it goes from there. So Bach was dealing with human crisis, and those cantatas every week were trying to take people through their own most difficult passages. And when you understand that music that way, I mean, one of the most beautiful things in a Bach aria is he usually gives you an obbligato, that the singer is with an oboe or a violin or a flute. And that's because Bach says no one should have to go through this alone. And you actually have a secret friend who is accompanying you on this really impossible passage. And in fact, who's repeating your line or prompting you or offering you a new melody or, you know, and so what I did with the Matthew Passion is basically staged that encounter with the direct encounter with the musician, that you're not just next to the violin, but you're singing to the violin and the violin is playing back to you. And there's an actual dialogue going back and forth between the person who's in crisis and the instrument that is their secret guardian angel that's trying to help them through it.
Back to talk more with Peter Sellers here on the Jefferson Exchange in just a minute 15. Stay tuned. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you so much for listening. Our guest today is Peter Sellers, who has a very, very long resume with many impressive productions in opera and theater and in film as well. He is visiting Southern Oregon University from UCLA and talking about his life and his work and all that goes on behind the process of putting things on stage. And there's a lot to it, obviously. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. We'll actually be talking tonight at 5:30 as well at the Mies Auditorium in the Arts Building on the SOU campus. So this is sort of a warm-up. We're our own warm-up act.
Exactly.
You get that, Peter? You can join the conversation here, though, at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email from Nicole in Grants Pass who says, I was lucky enough to attend a showing of Merchant of Venice at the Goodman Theater with one of my college classes. It was the first time I felt truly engaged with any of Shakespeare's work. I loved it so much I forgot all about the ensuing controversy. What a pleasant surprise to hear you discussing it on the Jefferson Exchange this morning.
Oh, Nicole, thank you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for that, Nicole.
Thank you.
And a call from Jeff in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Peter Sellers.
Oh, good morning to both of you.
Hi, Jeff.
Mr. Sellers, with the work that you do, it naturally makes you a student of history and of characters. I was wondering, how would you equate what's going on in the White House nowadays to some historical play or opera, and how did it end?
Thanks for that, Jeff.
Well, we're very fortunate to have the history of Rome, which Shakespeare was also pretty impressed with, which is, you know, something that literally moves from being a republic to being an empire. And when you really watch, you know, the kind of the certain idealism, you know, a certain point, and then finally the actual sheer military strength and sense of, you know, giant conquest overwhelms everything. And Shakespeare's plays treat, you know, that transition from Julius Caesar to Antony and Cleopatra, basically. So this next month I am doing a performance that I we did this summer in Salzburg of La Clemenza di Tito, which is the Emperor Titus, which is a really powerful example of somebody who is one of history's great monsters. The Emperor Titus was as a kid, and he was in charge of the Roman Empire army that destroyed the Second Temple in Jerusalem, that massacred the Jews and created enslaved the rest of them. And that kind of tragedy that occurred in the first century has echoed 20 centuries later. And this is one of history's most grotesque people. His dad was the emperor. When he came back from Jerusalem with everyone in chains, he then decided he would start the secret police because he heard people saying things about his dad he didn't like. And he was very famous for inviting someone to dinner and having them murdered before the first course came to the table. And he's just a vicious man, and he stepped in as emperor, succeeding his father. And he started doing all of these generous, strangely enlightened acts. He shut down the secret police. The Vesuvius exploded, and with his own money, he went and resettled the refugees. Then the plague struck Rome and a fire. Again, with his own money, he housed the homeless. And then mysteriously, after 18 months in office, he died. So he didn't have a chance to get really terrible. At the same time, how do you reconcile the guy he was with the guy he became? That's kind of incredible. And I think for me, it goes to the heart of, you know, you're only going to solve a problem when the person who's the problem becomes the solution. That you can't just vilify or criminalize or write someone off. You actually have to. It's only going to be a gang member who can solve the gang crisis, you know. And so you have to actually begin to recognize everybody as someone you're going to deal with, not just ignore. And so, bizarrely, you know, what's going on now, shall we say, has been going on for a long, long, long time. It's not just that a certain person was elected and suddenly we have this. It's actually, everything we're seeing has been set up for decades, and we're just seeing, you know, the crop you planted is what grows the next day. You know, that everything that we're looking at has been put in place for decades right now, but now we're forced to actually acknowledge it and then say what is the next crop we want to plant. So all of which is just to say we have wonderful things by Mozart, wonderful things by Shakespeare that really do treat this history very, very powerfully, and a history where there's no integrity in public life. And what does it take to actually return integrity to public life? And also, it's that amazing thing that human beings do change, and that's the miracle of human beings. I mean, it's also scary, but it's the miracle. And of course, why we do theater and why Shakespeare insists on Act 5, because you're really ready for the play to end in Act 4. And Shakespeare says, "No, actually, keep watching. Stay with this. No, no, really stay with this, and really stay with these people, because it's definitely not over yet."
In speaking about the kinds of stagings that are done, I mean, when you place a particular opera or play in a point in history or in a particular way of doing it, I mean, how tightly is that bound to the time in which it's created? I mean, I think by the time you did Don Giovanni as Blaxploitation, that genre had been like 20, 30 years behind, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's poetry. I mean, you're never doing one-for-one stuff because that gets too obvious and too reductive. No, the point is we've all grown up with all these references. And Shakespeare's plays are filled with all the references he grew up with. You know, it's just that is our world. Our world includes blaxploitation movies. It includes all this stuff. And so not to acknowledge it's there is to not acknowledge the world you're living in. So all I do is just bring all the stuff that we are all living with and put it on the stage, because that's what the stage is there for. As Shakespeare said, it's a mirror. So look in the mirror, and you need to make sure that everything that's around us is in that mirror. And otherwise, the mirror isn't actually an authentic reflection of the crazy contradictions and the non sequiturs and the shocking juxtapositions of our lifetime. You know, and you need, and people who are looking for more linear, you know, kind of reduced, shall we say, an easier image to swallow. In fact, life doesn't come that way. Nothing is really bite-sized, and you're going to have to chew for a while. So for me, the richness of all that is what's exciting, and the unpredictability. And again, if I could just come back to your question, which is so moving, the other side of what I'm doing with La Clemenza di Tito is I'm making it about, you know, how did Mozart know about Nelson Mandela? That finally, what is it like to recognize that history is actually changed not by things that are likely, but things that are unlikely. It is unlikely that a prisoner from a cell on Robben Island maximum security prison will be your next president. That's really unlikely. And theater is there to remind people not just of the likely. You know, the likely is what you read in the newspaper. What you see in the theater is the unlikely. And the unlikely is when life transforms and becomes magical. And every once in a while, it actually happens. And we have been alive in the era of Nelson Mandela.
We have indeed. You were, when you were talking about Bach, and Bach is a 12-step program. It's wonderful. You do speak frequently of spiritual force. And was that ever a religion per se for you? I mean, were you or are you a church-going person? Or?
Well, I think it's really important to have a kind of spiritual basis because obviously the materialism that we're in the middle of is so depressing and doesn't go very far. And so, but a lot of my life is also involved with the Quran. A lot of, I'm doing big Buddhist projects. I'm doing all these things that are, of course, are about the invisible world because everything important in your life is invisible. And if you're just limiting your life to what you can see and touch, then you've forgotten your grandmother. And so, like, hello.
Have you ever returned to works that you have done in the past and just sort of ripped out everything you did and done completely new versions?
Mostly not. Mostly what I did at a certain moment is not about me. It's about all the people that we were together with. And I want to just honor that moment when all these people came together and did something that was courageous. And I kind of, so I do leave it alone. And also with something like Don Giovanni or something like Shakespeare, you know, it's now time for other people to take that stuff up. You know, I did my thing with it whenever, and now it's time for a whole bunch of other people to take it where they're going to take it. So, you know, you don't want to just sit there forever. You want to just say, okay, hand this over as quickly as possible to the next set of people and let them run.
Let us take another call. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Peter Sellers.
Absolutely a brilliant interview, gentlemen. This is wonderful. Peter, you need to be teaching collaborative management techniques. Just listening to this, I've just been my head. I'm probably going to have to put in new vertebrae in my neck from nodding up and down as I've been going. The question that I have has to do with the change in social and political environment we've been going through for the last 2 or 3 years. Have you seen that have a chilling effect on your work, on the environment you're operating in, or the reception of your work? And I'll take my answers off the air. Jeff, a brilliant interview.
Oh, thank you so much.
You know, I just have to say, you know, it's when times get bad that art gets good. You know, all of the most important art is not made in pleasant times. It's made when everybody has to actually say, where do I stand? Who am I? And what do I really mean? And what do I care about? And what am I willing to go to the mat for? So for me, you know, it's like, you know, the great era of Polish and Czech art was, you know, during the juntas and in the crackdown and the Prague Spring. And all of that is the art that we, you know, that resonates. The powerful South African art comes from the anti-apartheid struggle, you know. And so for me, art becomes necessary and urgent when things get difficult. And at the same time, yes, you are sticking your neck out. And so a whole lot of people, yes, do defund your work. And suddenly certain things are not available and certain phone calls stop coming and so on. That is, of course, I've experienced that. And that is, I'm very fortunate to be able to work in Europe, to be able to work in Asia, to be able to work in lots of places and then bring some of that work to America because so I can support my work from many different angles. But I would also just say that the other reason that artists exist is somebody has to not worry about their job when they speak out. And most people can't speak out because they are worried about their job. And an artist is like, you've got almost nothing to lose. So you're just, there's no reason you can't actually say what's on your conscience. And that's why artists were invented. And we will always be, you know, out there hanging by our fingernails. And the support will come and go, and there'll be really lean times. But your job is to actually speak from the heart with as much honesty and courage as you possibly can, because you know most people do not have that luxury.
In fact, you once described theater as a maintenance system for democracy in ancient Greece. In what sense?
Well, it's somebody has to put forward what nobody wants to hear. And the Greeks, you know, what they decided to do was they made a theater where every citizen, the Athenians, every citizen was required to attend the theater. And the city council paid for your ticket if you couldn't afford it, but you had to be there if you voted. And then the plays are all about things nobody is proud of. Suicide among teenagers, parents killing their children, how you treated the prisoners in the last war, all these topics that are horrifying. And the Greeks put those topics in front of the whole community because human beings have a tendency to be a little smug. And the minute you hold in front of you what none of us have done well, what none of us are on top of or have the answer for, we get a little more humble, and we also realize we have to work together to work through these things that no court judgment, no court ruling is going to solve. It actually is going to be a whole community that has to move to a new place together, a new way to understand this, a new way to deal with it. And it's not legislative. That's really, really powerful. And so for me, that's the maintenance system for democracy. It's just, it takes us all back to a place where we realize that none of us have the answers. And we need to keep listening. We need to keep looking.
And keep producing, obviously. Many more works yet to come for Peter Sellars. This is really part one of two. Part two will be tonight at 5:30 with the two of us again at the Mies Auditorium at the Arts Building on the Southern Oregon University campus. Peter Sellars, a pleasure to have you in the studio. Looking forward to
Jeff,
talking to you again.
Jeff, pleasure is mine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.